Okay, good. So welcome everyone. So we're happy today to welcome Evan McDonough as our speaker. So Evan is currently a Kavli Fellow at KICP in Chicago, and he works at the interface between particle physics, astrophysics, and cosmology. He got his PhD from McGill in 2017, and then he was a postdoc at Brown, and a Banting Fellow at MIT before moving to Chicago, I guess, relatively recently. He's written a range of interesting papers on topics from like inflation, dark matter, cosmological colliders, you know, lots of topics near and dear to our hearts here at Perimeter. And today he'll be telling us about his recent work on early dark energy. So Evan, please take it away whenever you're ready.
Sure. Okay. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. I'm happy to be at Perimeter, if only virtually. The last time I was at Perimeter was in 2016 for fundamental physics and cosmology, something along those lines, which I enjoyed a lot. Perimeter is amazing. So, I mean, I guess the coffee would be better if I was there in person, but this will have to do. All right, so today I'm going to talk to you about early dark energy, which is a proposal for resolving the Hubble tension, and in particular, constraining early dark energy with large-scale structure. And this is in these two papers here, one with the first paper with Colin Hill and Stefan at Brown and Stefan's PhD student, Michael. And then the second one in collaboration with the West Coast EFT of LSS crew, namely Misha, Marco, and Matthias. And so most of this... Yeah, sorry. Yeah. East Coast being Leonardo and his folks. East Coast being Princeton IS. West Coast being Stanford. All right, starting the talk off on the right track, mixing up East and West. In any case, most of this work, I should acknowledge, was done while I was a Banting Fellow at MIT. And I'm particularly proud of this work because the proposal was cosmological complementarity in the dark universe, which is basically the idea is putting together cosmological observations from different redshifts, from a wide range of redshifts, to try and constrain theories of fundamental physics, which might be out of reach to traditional particle physics probes like colliders. So as I mentioned, the talk here is about the interface of early dark energy and large scale structure data. And how I'm gonna start out is, one, of course, the Hubble tension and potential resolutions. But then I wanna look at the early dark energy scenario and in particular, the observables beyond H naught. Then I'm gonna look at early dark energy, how it meets large-scale structure, and how cosmic shear weak lensing data can constrain the early dark energy scenario, and then reassess the early dark energy model using the effective field theory or electrical structure. That's that second paper with Misha, Marco, and Matthias. And then I'm going to spend a good chunk of time, and time allowing, talking about, one, the choice of priors. And so actually, we were the first papers to look in detail at the prior dependence of constraints on early dark energy. You can see in particular the appendices of our papers. But I just realized this morning that in fact, section 7, we titled prior dependence in this first paper. I spent a substantial portion of my life thinking about priors and early dark energy. And then with this in mind, thinking about early dark energy versus MCDM, what does the data prefer? And I'm gonna talk about these things in detail, but just to flash the punchline, and maybe I'll talk about these in detail later. So to start, obviously, is the Hubble tension, the reason why we're all here today. And I think what's particularly interesting and part of what got me excited about this and was the motivation for the work I'm going to talk about today, is that the Hubble tension is not simply CMB versus shoes. Although in particular, I mean, even going back as recently as this, the last big HNOT conference in June last summer, you know, right at the outset of the abstract for what is this conference, it states the Hubble tension is the discrepancy between Planck and shoes. But now we have actually on the right here, you know, we have this range of probes of H-naught, including direct measurements like shoes, and then the inference from Planck. And then also you can do CMB independent measures, for example, taking taking the BIO, taking a BBM prior on the amount of baryons, and then using dark energy survey to tell you how much total matter there is. And in doing this way, you don't need CMB at all, and you get a value that's consistent with the CMB. I think one thing that's particularly exciting though, and actually this work recently won, it's, you know, award-winning work, it recently won the Buckalter Cosmology Prize, is this work by the EFT folks on measuring H-naught using BOSS data, and in particular using not just the BAO but the full shape information, and extract doing cosmological parameter estimation with that using their effective field theory of large scale structure. I mean, this is of course also done by two other groups. So one class of resolutions, which is particularly interesting to me and someone with my background in sort of inflation and the high energy theory aspects of cosmology, is early universe solutions. And the basic premise here is to modify your cosmology in a way that satisfies the precision pH we have from the CMB. So which is to say, let's try and leave the CMB totally unchanged, but change the inference of H-naught. And the recipe to do this, the reason to do this, the reason why we're forced to do this, is that the angular scale of the sound horizon in the CMB is measured to incredible precision, so 0.03% precision. So you want to leave this angle fixed. So what you can do if you want to, H-naught sets the distance from us to last scattering. So if you want to increase H-naught, you are shrinking this distance. So if you want to leave theta unchanged, then you need to shrink the sound horizon. So that means you need to be doing something with H of Z around last scattering. And the sort of prototypical model, it's now not the only model to do this, but the canonical one is known as early dark energy. And the picture here is you have some axion-like potential, where you have some mass and a decay constant, and then an exponent. And so the role of the exponent is to define what is the shape of the potential. But the minimum, the reason why we're interested in axions is that some sort of physics needs to be happening around matter radiation equality, for the simple reason that this integral right here of the sound horizon is most sensitive to H of Z right around matter radiation equality, or right before last scattering, for example. So we know that the mass of this axion needs to be about Hubble at matter radiation equality, which is to say the general picture of an axion is it's stuck up its potential by Hubble friction. And then when Hubble drops below the mass, it starts to oscillate and minimize its potential. So that tells you that the mass of this field needs to be about 10 to the minus 27 EV. Now the fact that the Hubble tension is itself about a 10% discrepancy means you need to be raising H at that time by about 10%. And so the basic numerology then implies that the decay constant, needs to be about the Planck scale. Now the demand that we're really sequestering our new physics in the early universe demands that this exponent be greater than or equal to 2, which is to say it redshifts as fast or faster than radiation. So for example, if this, the canonical choice is n equals 3, so then it redshifts away faster than radiation, and it's effectively hidden from, or you would think it's hidden from the late universe. And then so the hope is that you could raise H-naught's inferred from the CMB, and then large scale structure would have nothing to say about it because it would be totally redshifted away. And this model is parametrized by 3 parameters. So you can go from, we call these the particle physics parameters, the mass and the decay constant, and the hyperparameters that specify the cosmology is the fraction of the universe that this new component comprises at its peak, we call this FEDE. And the time at which this happens, ZC, critical redshift. And then also an initial condition for the scalar field. An initial condition modifies the perturbations in a in somewhat subtle way that I won't get into here today. I should point out that there are many models now of the early dark energy scenario. And in particular, the ones that I'm fond of are sort of what I refer to as trigger field models, wherein you have, it's a dynamical process. It's a multi-field setup that explains why around this time you're having this sort of catastrophic change in the amount of dark energy in the universe from about an EV down to the milli electron volt that we observe as the Kolmogorov constant today. And there's also been other interesting ideas put forward. So let's go through in detail how exactly early dark energy achieves this goal. And so we have our code here on GitHub. You can download it and play with it yourself. So the basic physics all comes out of thinking about this evolution of the early dark energy energy density. So first of all, the fact that it starts to decay in this rapid decay of the early dark energy means that large scale perturbations, whereas they would usually be, they get redshifted as they're coming out of gravitational potential wells. We have this huge amount of energy, which is just rapidly dissipating away. The amount of redshifting those photons get is less, which if you just put in some early dark energy without any compensating effects, the net effect is that on large scales, this first BAO peak is raised. Simply due to the fact that you have this decay means you have less redshifting coming out of gravitational potential wells than you would have had otherwise. Now on this other side, the fact that you have this dark energy component early on, so this affects modes that entered the horizon already at this time, so they're small scale modes today. This changes the damping tail of the CMB. And it looks like a small effect, but we all know that the error bars are incredibly small in this range, so you really do have this small offset. But so let me back up and say for a second, the way to compensate then for this enhanced early ISW from tossing in this extra early dark energy component is to toss in more dark matter. So about 5% more dark matter to weight down those gravitational potential wells and restore the amplitude of the peaks of the CMB. So, but even if once you fix these peaks, you still have the damping tail is screwed up. And the way to do this is to raise the spectral index. So you raise it from 0.966 to 0.989. And just with these two simple changes, you get less than 1% change from lambda CDM. And this is in comparing lambda CDM with H0 is 68 to EDE with H0 is 72. So it really is the case that the early dark energy scenario can allow you to raise H0 substantially while not changing the CMB at all.
Can I ask Evan, so when you say adding 5% more dark matter, does that mean increasing omega matter by 0.05 or does that mean a fractional increase?
A fractional increase in the physical dark matter density, like little omega CDM. It's not like you're changing the abundance of dark matter by 5%, which would be a much bigger effect. But no, so this is a fractional increase in the amount of dark matter by 5%.
Okay, great, thanks.
So just to summarize this, so the goal of the early universe resolution paradigm was to be guided by the CMB, and the CMB is our most precise observable. Let's see if we can raise the H0 inferred from the CMB while not ruining the fit. And this is achieved in the early dark energy scenario. And you can download our class EDE code and play with this yourself. And we have nice notebooks that walk through this type of thing. So now, though, coming to large-scale structure, you would hope that this decay of the early dark energy means that you actually don't have to worry about it for the late universe. And large-scale structure would have nothing to say about early dark energy. But the fact that you've one, change the spectral index, and two, added in more dark matter. Even after the Oerdrich energy decays, this dark matter is still there. This enhanced amplitude of perturbations at small scales is still there. And what you find, if you look at the matter power spectrum, here's the ratio of the matter power spectrum in EDE versus that lambda CDM cosmology, where their C and B match perfectly, is on small scales, you find an order 10% change, 10% enhancement to the matter power spectrum. And here I'm showing this ratio at different redshifts, which I'll get to in a second. These are the midpoints of the five redshift bins of the dark energy survey. And so you can see actually the effect is even greater at high redshifts. And just to sort of drive this point home, it's the changes in the lambda CDM parameters which are doing this for you. So the early dark energy itself, it acts to suppress the growth of structure, in particular for the modes that are inside the horizon before the EDE, before this scalar field decays and the early dark energy itself redshifts away. And so you can see this down here, whereas as I increase the amount of the FEDE from the best fit value, what I'm doing is I'm suppressing the amount of power on small scales. So it's this extra dark matter and the change in NS, which is giving you an enhancement in the matter power spectrum, which is redshift dependent. So now let's think about what does large scale structure data have to say about this. And in particular, I'm thinking about the dark energy survey. And when we were writing this, we had the DES year one, and hopefully soon we'll have everything from DES year three. And in particular, looking at the set of three two-point correlation functions, which is the cosmic shear and the galaxy clustering. And so here's one example of a angular correlation function, where in the white region is the region of angular scales where the data is actually used. And you perform a scale cut where you just essentially throw away this information and look at, this is the range of angular scales where it's believed that the errors are under control. And so we can look at, in these regions and in these redshifts, translated roughly into a K-space, what is the impact of early dark energy? And indeed, again, you get about a 10% change in the matter power spectrum relative to lambda CDM in the early dark energy model versus, in early dark energy relative to lambda CDM. So this suggests already that large scale structure, and in particular dark energy survey, might have something to say about early dark energy. So now let's get to work and think about what confidential constraints we can get. So in particular, CMB taking Planck 2018, and large scale structure, one, of course, Planck 2018 lensing, which I separate out here because it's, morally speaking, a large scale structure data set. And then BAO from BOSS and the 60F galaxy survey, and redshift space distortions from BOSS DR12. Redshift space distortions correspond to anisotropic galaxy clustering, which itself probes F sigma 8. And this UK here, this is the angle between your line of sight and your K. And this is related to the Kaiser effect. And we can talk about this in more detail after. And maybe I could mention that the updated version of Donaldson's textbook, which is with Fabian Schmidt, is just fantastic. And I took this picture from their textbook. It's crazy how up to date their textbook is. Then we have the dark energy survey, three times set of three two-point correlation functions, which I just talked about. And then in addition to this, we're going to use the data from HSC and kids Viking 450, as parameterized by a prior on S8 being this combination of sigma 8, which is the variance of perturbations in a ball of radius 8 HM versus megaparsec. And then for supernovae, we have the Pantheon data set, which is, let me just mention that Pantheon differs from SHUs in that these are not calibrated. We just have the relative luminosity of about 1,000 supernovae. And then SHUs goes through this whole calibration, so the cosmic distance ladder, to arrive at this measurement of H0, which is about 74 And then let me mention that, so the most of the amount of work I'm going to present in the next few slides is following all papers on EDE that came before ours and taking uniform priors on the EDE parameters, and not to say the particle physics parameters. In particular, we're taking FEDE between 1% and 25%. We're demanding that the critical redshift be in between basically 3 and 4, and that the initial condition of this field is basically between 0 and pi. And I should mention too that the chains for everything I'm going to present, we put them online so you can download them and play with them yourself. But before I proceed, I want to issue a warning, which is actually one of the things that got me initially interested and excited about really dark energy, is thinking about the interplay with what we actually know about the action decay constant. So let me here issue this warning that when you impose priors on these hyperparameters, you're imposing wildly non-uniform priors on the particle physics parameters. And in particular, what is striking is that here, look at, this is the effective prior that you get on the action decay constant units of, this is log base 10 of the decay constant relative to the Planck scale when you're sampling uniformly in FEDE, like in the C in the initial angle. And what you find is that the implicit prior on the decay constant is peaked at the Planck scale. Now, this is sort of insane from the high energy theory perspective, where the last, 10, 15 years, going back to the early 90s, is work on this idea that there's no global symmetries in quantum gravity, which says that any theory that has a decay constant near the Planck scale is totally out of the control of effective field theory. And how you can, and I guess the weak gravity conjecture goes back to Akani Ahmed and Lubos and Nicholas and Vafa. But this is really was an updated version of the no global symmetries in quantum gravity argument. And the simplest form of the argument is that this cosine potential is self-generated by instantons, but you have instantons themselves are an infinite series weighted by the instanton action. And in particular, the instanton action of gravitational instantons goes like M Planck over F. If F becomes of order or larger than M Planck, this series, these CNs are just some order one numbers, is not approximated by the first term. You have to include the infinite series of terms. So for this reason, this was in large part, this is a motivation for axiom monodromy inflation, which is now one of the most well-studied inflation models, was the fact that natural inflation needs a Planckian decay constant. So this is pretty accepted and ingrained into the theory community that Planckian decay constants are in general not well motivated from any theory construction.
So what happens if you sample in the parameter space that's well motivated by particle physics? Does this just not work, or?
Yeah, so there what you have is the effective prior on FEDE is peaked towards small values. So we have that in the paper, I didn't put it in my slides. But yeah, so we did the opposite as well. And you find that you find an effective prior on FEDE, which is peaked towards small values. So it downweights the region that you're interested in sampling, which is about 10%.
And I guess related is the critical redshift that you choose here. Is there some reason why you don't go to redshifts lower than recombination? I guess that just goes in the wrong direction for H naught. Is that really the only reason, or?
I mean, the truthful reason is that you'll never find it if you take the prior to be too big. So I think the truthful reason is that you take a relatively narrow range in order to get the posteriors to be separated from the boundary of the prior, and by focusing in on the region where you think you can find it to actually find it. And I should mention, so when we first started doing this with Colin, we were taking, I think, from 1 to 7, and that's taking an insane amount of time to converge. And so we eventually switched to what was used in all the ED papers that came before us. Mm-hmm. Now, to just belabor this point a little bit, because I've seen many talks on EDE and I've never seen this mentioned, but we actually have theory priors on the axion decay constant. And there's one very nice paper by Jim Halverson, Andrew Long, Brian Nelson, and Salinas, where they look at different string theory setups and say, what do they predict for the axion decay constant? And the scenario there is you want to understand the structure of the landscape. And if you say statistically, we're most likely to be in the setups that have the most solutions. One, so the prediction that they have for the axion decay constant, if you're in the most likely place, that should be about 10 to the minus 6 of the Planck scale. And then they consider all the different setups, and you basically find a, this is for the 1 over F. You find these sort of Gaussian distributions in log space for the decay constant, depending on the different setups. And then, so let me mention two things. One, sort of the aim of this research program was to motivate experiments looking for axions. And so what they said is that it is well motivated from a string theory perspective to search for axions, because by virtue of the fact that these couplings in the decay constant could be in the range that's interesting. And then two, just to point out that this work and the series of papers that this is a part of, this is what won them this big NSF AI center, which is Harvard and Northeastern. Core is leading up the Harvard crew and Jim is leading up the Northeastern side of things. And they also have some CS people. So this was like, I'd say some pretty important work, and which is to say, and so in the theory community, there is a theory prior on F, and at the loosest level, it's just that F should be much less than the Planck scale in order to have any sort of well-defined effective field theory. And then there's more precise theory prior than what we think the axion decay constant should be in our most current theories of axions. So an appetizer before we get to the full posteriors is just to look at the CMB. We did the first fit to Planck alone. This had not appeared in any work prior to our 2003 paper. And so the procedure I laid out for getting the CMB correct in the other Kennedy scenario really does play out in the posteriors, where you have a degeneracy between FEDE and H naught. But this degeneracy is accompanied by needing to increase the amount of dark matter in a way that's orthogonal to how dark matter H naught degeneracy is in lambda CDM. So if you want to increase H naught, meaning increase FEDE, you also need to increase the amount of dark matter. And this effect combined with the fact you need to increase NS means that the posterior, the degeneracy for S8 is also orthogonal to what it is in lambda CDM. So here's my artist rendering of what the SAH naught degeneracy direction looks like in lambda CDM versus an EDE. And then the DES measurement is down here. So in lambda CDM, the weak lensing data pulls H naught higher versus it has the opposite effect in the other kinetics. We anticipate it'll move the H naught lower. And these chains, as well as everything I'm going to show, is available on the Flatiron servers. I'm just going to check my watch, take a sip of tea. So what we did was to consider really dark energy, the constraints that come from many different combinations of data sets, to try and answer this question of, is do we really get cosmological concordance out of the early dark energy scenario, which is ultimately the aim of the broader aim of resolving this Hubble tension. So let's move through these sequentially. One, looking at Planck, what you find is that the posterior is peaked on the boundary and you get sort of a weak upper bound moving. It's loosely consistent with about 10%, which is what you would think you need to resolve the Hubble tension. Now, if we add in the data sets that every paper before us used, meaning lensing, BAO, Pantheon, space distortions, and shoes, this is where you find the peak proof of early dark energy. So this is the main cell of early dark energy as a relation to the Hubble tension is this blue curve right here, nicely separated from the boundary at zero. And you find that FEDE is non-zero at 3.1 sigma. So this is the three sigma detection of EDE. And the Hubble tension is reduced to 1.7 sigma. But now let's ask what happens when we toss in more data. In particular, you toss in dark energy survey, zooms a bit to the left, you pick up some support in the back of the prior, you add in kids and HSC, and now the evidence for EDE FED greater than zero drops below 2 sigma. You have substantial support in the boundary of the prior. And now if you consider all of these things without shoes in the mix, what you find is the result is even tighter than what you see with Planck alone. So this is this teal curve here. And the constraint is that FEDE is less than 6% at 95% confidence in comparison to the 10% that you need to resolve the Hubble tension. And the H naught value you find is in 3.3 sigma tension with shoes, which is it's at 68.9 relative to lambda CDM, which is 68.3 and about double the error bar. These are statistically consistent. So the tension with shoes is not alleviated when you consider Planck and all the ultrastructure data that we have. And even putting all data sets together, the evidence for shoes is less than 2 sigma. And then let me point out one other thing, which I put in and then removed from the slide. I didn't want it to be too cluttered, is that even thinking about just within EDE fit to different data sets, are the posteriors you find for EDE consistent with one another. And I would say the fact that going from blue, for example, to teal shows that, so the peak proof of EDE and the fit to all large structure and CMB data without shoes, this in itself, these things are in about 2 sigma, I think it was 2.3 sigma tension. So again, in that sense, and in the sense that you're not consistent with shoes, the dark energy model is not restoring cosmological concordance. Instead, what you find is a tight constraint on FEDE. And again, let me emphasize that a substantial portion of the talk, after I go through these constraints, will be talking about how to interpret these posteriors and dependence on priors and things.
So I have a question regarding the
sure.
parameter.
Yeah, so here...
Different value of n?
Right, so it's basically only very weakly constrained if you promote it from a fixed integer to some arbitrary real number. So this is done in the 1811 paper, where they consider different integer values of n and then allow n to float. And the result of their analysis was that the best model was n equals 3. And so in our analysis, we didn't consider the other choices. And indeed, in the literature, this has become sort of the benchmark model.
And is there a reason why n equal to 3 is kind of the best choice? Like, did you mention anything about that?
So n equals 2 redshifts like radiation, n equals 3 redshifts faster than radiation. But other than that, I don't have a good explanation. I think there's probably some physical argument that lies in thinking about the sound speed of perturbations as you change the shape of the potential. But nobody's ever made that precise.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks. And let me say, anyone feel free to interrupt anytime with questions. And hopefully we'll have some time at the end for lots of questions. So maybe I should speed up a little bit. So far what I've been thinking about is electrical structure data in the form of dark energy survey and other weak lensing cosmic shear observations and redshift space distortions. But one major caveat to all of this is when comparing to electrical structure data is the modeling of the nonlinear matter power spectrum. And the conventional way to do this and what we did following all past papers is to use these fitting formulas like halo fit. And the premise of these fitting formulas is that they perform n-body simulations in the context of lambda CDM to calibrate your fitting formula that then you can go and use to calculate nonlinear not a power spectrum for any parameters. So Lambda CDM is baked into things like Halefit and HM code. Although I should mention that we did check the consistency of DS year one in EDE when you switch out the, when you look at the Halefit modeling nonlinear power spectrum and DES versus a prior on SA and DES. And I can talk about that in more detail. But it's a sizable caveat to any scenario of an alternative for them to CDM looking at large structured data. And it's worth exploring in detail.
It's not on linear scales then? Like, is that what you're saying?
Sorry?
So for Halefit, it doesn't matter. Will the fits have to be sensitive to nonlinear scales?
Right? So that, I think the dark energy survey, three times 2-point correlation functions are sensitive to nonlinear scales.
I had the impression, from your previous slide that they were trying to, remove IK modes for their parameter constraints.
Yeah, so those, they remove certain modes where they think the data isn't trustworthy. So there's like systematic errors or things, and they only take a selection of angular scales. So they're looking in angles, not in k-space dimension. And those cuts correspond to where they think that the data can be trusted.
Okay, but they are sensitive, you're saying, to k greater than 0.1.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we did a consistency check, which is one of the appendices of our papers, and I have a slide on it that we can talk about. But for the moment, I'm just presenting this as a motivation. And the other, another important motivation for maybe a more detailed analysis of structure is that when you parametrize the BOSS data, just in terms of a few small numbers, so you're going from this 3D mounted power spectrum down to a small set of numbers. So this is the actual likelihood that comes in Cobaya. There's a huge compression of information when you do this. And in particular, in order to go from the 3D mapper spectrum to this small set of numbers like F sigma 8, you have to impose what's called shape priors, or it's the Planck priors and the dark matter invariant densities, which are fixed to their, so you fix these Lambda CDM parameters to their best fit values in the fit of Lambda CDM to Planck. So in a sense, Lambda CDM is already baked in to this compressed likelihood for the redshift space distortions. So again, here, you're going from this 3D object down to, for example, just F sigma 8. And Lambda CDM is baked in when you do that. So a way to go further than using this compressed likelihood and having to rely on fitting formulas is what's known as the effective field theory of large scale structure. And so we're probably all familiar with the fact that a linear order and perturbation theory in GR, so not modified gravity, the anisotropic stress vanishes. And so, for example, the two gravitational potentials, capital phi and capital psi, are equal at linear order and perturbation theory. Once you go beyond linear order, that's not the case. So you have anisotropic stress at second order in perturbations, which, for example, I can just take a derivative of a scalar and then another derivative of a scalar, and then I form some anisotropic stress. And more generally, every nonlinearity you can think of can be parametrized as a effective stress tensor. So you can think of the nonlinearities of gravity, just move it from the left-hand side of the Einstein equation to the right-hand side of the equation. And you can think of this as being an effective stress tensor, which has all possible terms that a stress tensor could have. And so by enumerating all possible terms that a stress tensor could have, you're effectively, you're writing down all operators that could exist in your low energy effective field theory. And so this goes by the name, the effective field theory of large scale structure. And this is pioneered in the early 2010s, and Simon Forman, who's here, is one of the main players in this research program. He worked at the two-loop matter power spectrum, a ton of fantastic work. And actually Simon introduced me to the EFD of LSS at first at Lazouche, and then when I was visiting Stanford ostensibly visiting Andre Renata, and my advisor was on sabbatical there, but it was fantastic to sitting in on the edges, listening to Leonardo and Simon and people chat. And so the basic premise here of this effective field theory framework is that you can take your spectrum, your perturbations, and instead of just spending out in this leading order bias parameter, you can introduce nuisance parameters, which parameterize all possible ways that you could correct the fluctuation in the galaxy spectrum. And you can do the same thing with the anisotropic piece, so the multipole moments of the power spectrum. You have a tree level result, and then you have all possible corrections. So you have a loop correction, you have some stochastic noise, and then you have a set of counter terms coming from effectively in a well-defined precise sense, we're normalizing the coefficients in this effective stress tensor. And it may be a simpler, you could ignore the words effective field theory completely and just say that we're introducing nuisance parameters into the modeling of the nonlinear spectrum. And we're going to marginalize over those in a Bayesian analysis. And those nuisance parameters parameterize all possible physical effects from, for example, environmental dependence and from errors in how you're measuring things. And let me mention, there's been some pretty big recent successes. So for example, the CMB independent measure of H naught, which itself is closely tied in with the CMB independent measure of the dark matter density. And also a nice constraint on some of the neutrino masses. And this is working with done by both the West Coast and the, I did it again, done by both the East Coast and the West Coast groups. So let's look at EDE and BOSS data, BOSS DR12, the retrospace distortions, and in the context of the effective field theory lexical structure. So what I want to emphasize is one, so here is the solid is the MCDM, and the dash is EDE with some fixed set of bias parameters compared to the data. If you take the best fit bias parameters, what you find is that lambda CDM and EDE become nearly indistinguishable. So it's this fact that you are marginalizing over these different bias parameters is super important to estimating how well can the data actually constrain your model. And then looking at the error bars, and you can estimate what is the chi-squared difference between these two things, and it works out to be about 2. And so in total, putting together the different redshifts and different patches, you get most of the difference is coming from this one data set, and you get a total chi-squared difference about 2.5. Just a simple frequentist estimate based on, given the data, what's the difference between lambda CDM and EDE expressed as a chi-squared.
What's on the left and what's on the right here?
So on the bottom left is the fractional difference between EDE and lambda CDM. And on the right, on the bottom left, sorry, is so it's relative to lambda CDM. And on the right, it's relative to the error bars of the data. Sorry for not mentioning that. Yeah, so the difference between these is that here you would think it's the L equals 2 mode where you most expect to see the difference. But actually, because the error bars are much smaller in the monopole, the where you can really get a big difference is in the monopole.
And this is the best fit to each of these models?
Yeah, exactly. Sorry. So left top goes from fixed bias parameters to right best fit bias parameters. And now on the bottom here, I'm fixing. So that's just, pulling apart this plot here and looking at the difference between EDE and lambda CDM, they look indistinguishable. So right, so this is for the best fit bias parameters and the best fit EDE. And then, so this is just an estimate of the change in chi-squared you would get.
And what's going on in the dashed line in the top left there? The dashed line?
Yeah, so this, the top left is fixed bias parameters. Take the best fit EDE already quoted without doing any EFT LSS analysis. So this is like a warm up to just say, should we expect an analysis of BOSS data using EFT to be able to constrain EDE at all? So take the best fit EDE that you find without doing EFT LSS analysis. And the best fit learning CDM you find in the same way. And fix the bias parameters. And what you get is the solid and dash things are, dash lines are learning CDM and EDE. So the difference between them is huge.
Mm-hmm.
But if you find the best fit bias parameters, okay. So you find that changing the bias parameters can compensate for the differences in the chronological parameters, which sort of shows the importance of allowing these bias parameters to vary, because there can be pretty substantial compensations that can happen. But nonetheless, the difference between EDE and LEMIS-CDM in this sort of simple exercise is about 2.5, which is, I mean, not huge, but also not zero. So this would be...
Can I ask you, so you're adding two extra parameters and then you improve chi squared by 2.5. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, it's actually three parameters. So I should say this is like a warm-up exercise. So what we'll actually do is compute the best fit, and then you can look at the chi-square. So this is just a warm exercise to say, this is the sort of improvement one would expect if you were to do the analysis, which I'm about to present. Right, so the results is the posteriors, when you look at Planck plus the Boss data, analyzed using the effective field theory of inertial structure. And what you find is an upper bound on FEDE, which is about 7% and 95% confidence. And you find a value of H naught, which is in 3.6 sigma tension with shoes. And so for example, here on the top left, red is LEMIS-CDM, blue is early dark energy, and these gray bands are the shoes region, 1 and 2 sigma. And to really isolate what is going on in those posteriors and what is the effective field theory doing for us, and one, let's look at the dark matter density. When you look at just Planck and then looking at BAO plus a standard full shape, so that compressed likelihood, we just take a small set of numbers, and then the BAO and Planck and the effective field theory. And the in particular, if you look at the dark matter density, here is green being just with Planck, and you see that the constraint, the upper bound here on the amount of dark matter that you can have is drastically reduced by going from blue to red, which is going from the standard full shape to the effective field theory description for the full shape of the matter power spectrum. So effectively, it's the EFT analysis of BOSS is not allowing this increased dark matter density that you need to get the larger H naught in EDE, or we'll call it this increased dark matter density is necessary to get the CMB right while raising H naught. But then the EFT doesn't let you increase the dark matter density. And so what this has the effect of doing is tightening the constraint on FEDE. And all of this is consistent.
So do you understand, what in the BOSS data doesn't like the higher omega matter?
In terms of looking at the broadband shape of the matter power spectrum, start to measure what is omega m from that.
It was not like the time dependence of the BAO feature or something. You're saying that the broadband shape.
Yeah, it's the broadband shape.
Hmm.
Are the same scales used in both of this? The K-max is effectively the same in both the standard analysis and the EFT one?
That's a good question. I don't recall, but I can look into that. I would assume that the answer is yes, but I don't want to. I don't want to make an incorrect statement.
So can I ask a question? And why do we trust this EFT for early dark energy? I mean, shouldn't we calibrate it against simulations with early dark energy?
So the reason for the EFT is because we can trust it with any cosmological model. I mean, because the EFT is this is laid out nicely in these papers. This is the most general object you can write down, right? It's the most general low energy effective field theory for for linear and mildly nonlinear modes, you can write down consistent with the equivalence principle and rotational symmetry. So,
but in some sense, early dark energy violates the equivalence principle because you have additional, basically you have a fixed force, or you have additional lighter scalars, which propagates.
There's only a fifth force if it couples universally, right? Like putting in an axion field does not imply a fifth force. It's just some light scalar degree of freedom. So it does not violate the equivalence principle.
But when they say equivalence principle, what they mean is that there's basically the only degree of freedom is CDM. So if there are other degrees of freedom in the problem, then those also should enter this formula.
But there's literally no other operators you can write down. This is all possible ways that you can organize like rank two tensors and derivative rank two tensors and derivatives on them.
This is just for CDM. But if you have dark energy,
but so what? But what operator would you? What operator would you write down then that only has two indices?
Density and velocity of dark energy.
Right. So you can. Okay. So you're saying there would be a direct coupling, for example, between. Not just gravitational coupling then. So if you only have gravitational coupling to dark matter.
No, but dark energy does gravitate. So. If it's homogeneous and does gravitate, then there would be an additional term in that. But I'm just saying that's a possibility, not that there is going to be a big effect.
If you have a direct interaction, you would have new terms. If it only couples gravitationally, you wouldn't.
But isn't this model constructed so that these things kind of turn off by the time things are going nonlinear? So all it changes is the linear matter power spectrum?
Yeah, that is the premise for the model, but you could ask more generally, effective field theory applied to alternative CDM. Mm-hmm. And if the new thing you're tossing in does not couple directly to any fields but gravity, then this is the most general object you can write down. But this is something I'm actively working on, I should mention, is thinking about generalizing oerdrich energy to like an early dark sector and things like this. But this is the most general object you can write down, unless there's some other direct coupling. But thank you very much for the question. Right. So this story here, what does EFT get you is in complete parallel with the H-naught paper and the cosmological parameter paper by Misha and Matthias and Marco. That the new information in the full shape likelihood is that you can get a measure of omega matter. And if you know omega barium from DBN, then this is allowing you to measure the dark matter density. Now what happens if we take the BOSS data and the weak lensing data? We toss all the best data we have at the wall with the Planck data. And what you find is the constraint on FEDE, the tightest constraint to date, is less than about 5% of the universe at 95% confidence. And the value of H naught, 68.7, is consistent with what you find in the MCDM, which is 68.13. So essentially, when you toss in weak lensing and the BOSS data analyzed using EFT, what you find is that basically EDE is being pushed to the regime where it just acts like the MCDM. So now to sort of contextualize. Sorry?
Can I ask a question on the previous slide?
Yeah.
So are the bias parameters kept fixed for these both the plots?
No. So here in this slide, this is using the effective field theory, where all the bias parameters are marginalized over, are sampled very marginalized over in these posteriors.
Okay, thanks.
So now to sort of analyze these results, and we're gonna do some frequentist comparisons and things. And there's been a lot of talk in the literature and in talks, I'm almost out of time, aren't I? 10:57. Can I have 5 minutes extra? Would that be awful?
No, yeah, it's fine. Go ahead.
So 2019 and 2020 were interesting years in the development of priors and what priors we should take in cosmology. And the first thing I noticed by Sunny, like Nazi, who does like a tremendous amount of tremendous work, does amazing work, is that he put forward this idea of what if you had a physical theory that you had a strong theory prior for some parameters. And so the null hypothesis isn't that they're zero, but you have a theory prior that they're non-zero. So this is very similar to like, if you could, you can try to constrain the reheating temperature if you fix a model of inflation, which gives you a theory prior on what NS is. That's it. So this is an interesting question. And then this idea bled in very quickly bled into early dark energy, particularly looking at first with this, the new early dark energy model, where you write down a six parameter model and then sample two of the parameters. And you say, we fixed the other ones because we think we have some justification for doing so. We don't actually have the theory in hand, but you can imagine that if there was a theory. And then this became sort of more sophisticated even with this two-step analysis where we vary both M and F. And then you find the best fit values of those parameters. And then you do a second posterior sampling where you fix M to its best fit value. So, which is to say, we don't have the theory, but you could imagine you had the theory and that theory predicted the best fit value. But because we don't have the theory, we'll do posterior sampling, find the best fit value for my second parameter, take that now as a prior, take my posterior as a prior, redo posterior sampling, and see what constraint you get on FEDE. And then this methodology found its way sort of thoroughly ingrained into early dark energy with this paper by Vivian Co, which was a response to our analysis of the weak lensing DS data, where they put forward the same idea that you should fix two of the parameters to their best fit values, and then look at the results that you get for FEDE. And let's just see what happens when you do this. So I did this in about 5 minutes. I took the chains from the fit to Planck alone, and then I did importance resampling to put a prior on the EDE parameters. And I mean, importance resampling is always somewhat of a shady thing to do, but here we really have millions of samples. So it's somewhat justified. And this is just a illustrative phenomenon is we can go from, indeed, we can go from a posterior that's peaked on the boundary, FED goes to zero, to saying, oh, here we have about, this is almost two sigma evidence of EDE, simply by I put two priors on the EDE parameters, the timing and the initial condition. So you could, I'm saying, imagine I had a theory which could fix these to the best fit values. I'm going to take that as my prior. And what you get is this red curve, which is, you know, maybe somewhat compelling. And then as you, if you impose the SA prior, this shifts downward and you still get lots of support on the boundary, but you know, you still have pretty non-trivial support for FEDE is non-zero. You know, so this is the procedure that was done in these series of papers, including the response to our essay analysis. And okay, sure, this begs the question, does the data allow or perhaps even prefer really dark energy?
And, so I'm puzzled actually, sorry, I'm moved by this. Like, so if you go back to that slide, okay, like, no, I'm going to the next one, like, with the plot. So the gray line, you're saying peaks at FEDE equals zero.
Mm-hmm.
And at FEDE equals zero, you don't care what the other parameters are because there's like zero.
Yeah, exactly.
So why is it then that when you then fix the other parameters to something, then it does start to care what?
Well, it's that it's finely tuned the area. This it's in the full 3D parameter space. This represents a finely tuned region, versus if you And you're throwing away the uncertainties due to these parameters, essentially. So you're exactly right that in the lambda CDM limit, these parameters are totally unconstrained. And so by fixing them to be in the finely tuned region that you need them to be in, then you find that FEDE is actually, and you vary only FEDE, that non-zero FEDE is actually somewhat preferred. Whoops. So I'm gonna talk about this.
Oh, okay, sorry. Okay.
In more detail, because I have a plot showing marginalized versus best fit likelihood profiles, which I think will sort of answer that question. And before I get to some plots, let me mention that the sort of the three punchlines I want to communicate is that one, when you look at the Planck plus all social structure data, the best fit EDE is not close to the H not resolving EDE, which is to say the best fit EDE is about 1% versus you need about 10%. Then second, the H not resolving EDE, for example, if you fix FEDE to be about 10% and you ask what's the best fit EDE I can find, it's actually a worse fit to the data than lambda CDM. So that the best fit EDE is not close to resolving the tension. The H not resolving EDE is a much worse fit to the data, meaning the Bossful shape and all the S8 data by a substantial amount. And three, these statements are not driven by prior volume effects. And those prior volume effects, the degeneracy that you just pointed out, the impact of that is it punishes fine tuning. So now let's spend just a few minutes on this very busy slide. And what I'm comparing here is in thin lines, looking at the best fit log likelihood at every value of FEDE. So you fix a value of FEDE and you vary all your parameters to find the best fit. And then in the thick lines, I'm looking at the marginalized posterior. So the difference between the thin and the thick lines tells you the degree of fine tuning. And this is the prior volume effect, essentially, when you marginalize over the posteriors or all your parameters, the fact that you have these unconstrained parameters and certain limit, that's captured by the difference between the best fit and the marginalized likelihood profile. And then red and blue here correspond to the full shape using effective field theory electrical structure, and then the full shape and Planck and all the S8 data. All right, so this first point I want to point out is that there is the best fit EDE is non-zero, but it's about 1%. It's 1.5%. And you get a nice reduction with regards to lambda CDM. I mean, that's subjective what you call nice, but you reduce the chi-squared relative to lambda CDM by 4. Now, on the other hand, the H not resolving ED cosmology is over here. FED is about 10%. And if I look at just a subset of the structure data, which is full shape, so take the full shape and Planck, what you find is indeed the best fit EDE, that does to a certain extent resolve the Hubble tension. There's only a modest decrease in the chi-squared relative to lambda CDM. But now if I toss in, if I'm using all the natural structure data that I have, which is BOSS and S8 data, I move from this red star down to this blue star, where the chi-squared is substantially diminished relative to lambda CDM. And this is the best fit, which suggests that the H not resolving EDE is a worse fit to the data than lambda CDM. And finally, as I mentioned before, the difference between the best fit and the marginalized posteriors, this is how you quantify in a precise sense this prior volume effect of large degeneracies appearing in some limit, which I should mention happens anytime, say, you model a foreground with an amplitude and a spectral index.
This only looks at one kind of prior volume effect, right? I mean, there's another kind, which is like you could go to really low values of FEED, right? Like you could have a logarithmic prior, but you know, it could be. Mm-hmm. Have you looked into that? Like if you just had a prior in log FEED space and you can go to like really low values of that are preferred over other ones?
We haven't done that, but we've done. So I have plots of what if you redid all this, all these analyses with a lower bound on FED, which is like 4%, so that you can't get close to the, so I say that the lower bound of my prior is here to the right, what this best fit is, and then ask. So I forbid myself to go into the region where the prior volume effect is dominating. What do I get for the posteriors? But looking at a log prior, no, we didn't do that, but that's an interesting question. Thank you. Okay, I'm already 8 minutes over time. I'm so sorry. I personally really don't like it when people go over time. I'm like getting hungry, I'm getting thirsty. So this is my last sort of content slide, and I have a bunch of extra slides which we can talk about. But so the final thing I want to mention is we did a sensitivity forecast for Euclid. And the result of this is that assuming the null hypothesis, which is an MCDM, and measurements consistent with its predecessors, what would be the upper bound on FED that you could find? This is, we tried to work an analogy to sensitivity forecasts of tensor scalar ratio, like people do for Simons and SimBS4. And we find that the level of sensitivity you should have with Euclid is to measure, you could measure, assuming the null hypothesis, the upper bound on FED you would get is about 1%. Had 95% confidence, which is to say, you know, next generation lecture structure experiments will be able to put very tight constraints or discover sort of the phenomenologically interesting region of early dark energy. So let me just summarize now, and you know, I could just honestly leave this slide up and take questions, but let me just mention that the premise of the early dark energy model is to introduce new degeneracies in the fit to the CMB. And these degeneracies are broken by the early dark energy model. And there's a very nice paper by Djemzik and Pogosyan and Zhao from October, which explains this in a more model independent way, talking about can you resolve the Hubble tension just by changing the sound horizon? And their conclusion is it's not possible to do that without running into problems with our shell structure. So I think this is a general statement which it extends beyond early dark energy and applies to really universe resolutions of Hubble tension, or specifically those that are changing the sound horizon. And where to go from here? I think looking at early and late sort of hybrid resolutions, and the obvious way to do that is interacting dark sector. So you have multiple fields interacting, and it's a more, maybe a more severe modification in lambda CDM, but one that I think is pretty compelling given that, you know, the search for the one, thinking about dark matter is just one WIMP, really didn't turn anything up. So now we think about dark matter as multiple components. There's no reason to think that dark energy would not follow the same, or not have the same feature. And then also, I think it'll be interesting to revisit some of the analyses on ultralight, actually on dark matter, using the effective field theory of electrical structure to look at the constraints that you can get in terms of what is the fraction of dark matter that, say, a 10 to the minus 27 EV axion could be. And more generally, one thing that I'm excited about, and I think that there's a lot of excitement about, is large-scale structure constraints on physics beyond the standard model. And I think that, you know, as a theorist, people are going to go out and spend billions of dollars on building these large-scale structure experiments. It's always, you know, there's an imperative for theorists to think about what types of new physics should we learn for large-scale structure. And I think, you know, a discovery or constraints of early dark energies is one of the things you can do. So thanks for coming, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Evan. So let's all unmute. Give him a round of applause. In view of the time, why don't we stop the official seminar here so that people can feel free to leave.